Chapter 1, The Day the Mask Cracked. It was the fall of 1991. The phone rang, and nothing made sense after that. It was a family friend, and he sounded serious. Hearing his voice, I knew instantly that something was wrong. "Are you sitting?" he asked. "Yeah, I am. What's going on?" And then he said, "Scott jumped off the Golden Gate Bridge." The world went still. My body froze. I went flat, like my insides just turned off. An instinct took over. And then I said, "Did he succeed?" I didn't want him to live. I was imagining him in a hospital bed, his body shattered into pieces, with my parents sitting beside him, trapped and taking care of their invalid son for the rest of their lives. "Yes," he said, "he's gone." Relief hit first, then guilt. What kind of a brother feels relief that his own brother actually died? But he was my only brother, and we had been arch enemies for years. He had pushed me away, but now he was gone, and he was just 20 years old. "Okay," I said, just going on autopilot. "I'll be on the next plane." On the flight from LA to San Francisco, I kept thinking about what life would be like without him. I remember telling myself, almost defiantly, that I wouldn't let his death change me. That lie didn't last long. Scott's memorial was beautiful. Friends and family gathered from everywhere. Our home was full of people who loved him, loved us, people who were grieving with us. At one point, we stood in my parents' living room, maybe 50 of us, hand in hand, a circle of loss and love. I felt more connected that week than I ever had. Yes, his death was devastating, but in the middle of all that connection, I felt a closeness to friends and family that I'd never known. And then, all of a sudden, it was gone. The black hole. My grieving had barely started when my parents, with the encouragement of well-meaning friends, decided it was time for me to go back to school. The message was clear. Go back, get back to your life, you'll be fine. But I wasn't. I wasn't ready. What I needed was to be around people who knew me, people I felt safe with. Instead, I was put back on a plane to Los Angeles with the unspoken family rule hanging over me. Pull it together. The first time it knocked me flat was when walking across campus at UCLA. I'd just come back from Scott's memorial. The sun was blazing. Students walked to class like nothing had happened. Couples held hands. From a dorm window, you could hear music blasting. Flyers were being passed out for a comedy night, blood drives, and the usual campus noise. My legs went shaky. My chest felt hollow. I just stood there, scared and alone. 2 weeks after we buried my brother, I was surrounded by thousands of people, but I had never felt more disconnected in my life. That week, I was sitting in the fraternity house when one of the older guys shoved a pledge brother into my room. "Talk to Hurst," he said. "His brother just committed suicide." The poor kid stood there like a deer in headlights. I felt bad for him, for both of us. I told him he didn't have to do this, that he could just leave. Neither of us knew what the hell to say. I kept trying to go through the motions, show up to class and show up at the fraternity, but the smallest things would set me off. I remember being at the Tijuana border, sent by my pledge class to buy Everclear for some idiotic tiki party we were putting on. Cars inched along, uneven and restless, while beggars and vendors wove through the gaps. Kids with tan faces knocked at windows, selling chiclets, blankets, or whatever they had. I didn't understand their lives, but I knew the raw edge I saw in their eyes, because I felt it too. And some days, when I needed to just hide out, I would go to this little cafe in one of those dim, worn-in places with mismatched chairs and the smell of burnt coffee. I'd sink into a corner table and then spend hours doodling in my notebook, making these strange dark shapes over and over, lines parallel to one another, filling the page. In those moments, moving the pen across the paper, I could just disappear. Some mornings, I couldn't even move. I'd wake up in my dorm room under a crushing weight. Midterms, auditions, papers, none of it mattered. I couldn't summon the energy. I couldn't fake it anymore. A black hole had opened in my chest, and it was pulling me under. My mind kept replaying Scott's final moments. His fall from the bridge. The way the water must have risen like a pane of glass. The obit said the Coast Guard pulled him from the freezing bay with faint vital signs. I couldn't stop wondering, was he conscious? Did he feel the pain? The cold? Or had he already slipped past the point of feeling anything at all? I ran the scene over and over in my head, not to make sense of it, just trying to make it real. When the grief wasn't paralyzing me, something else crept in. Fear. This endless, creeping dread that something even worse was coming. Another shoe would drop. Maybe my parents would die. Maybe something else would happen that I couldn't handle. I felt like I was always bracing, waiting for the next disaster. I stumbled through the next few years, searching for anything that might help me feel okay again. I chased new experiences, new landscapes, anything that promised relief. For brief moments, I could almost convince myself I was free. But beneath every change of scenery, something in me was still unraveling. That's when the guilt started creeping in. The voice. I was lost. I had dropped out of UCLA and moved back near my parents. I was still grieving my brother's death and had just blown up one of the few friendships that still meant something to me. My friends Steven and Theo, the guy I'd crossed, were close. And when I got involved with Theo's girlfriend, Luna, I crossed a line. When it all blew up, Steven cut ties. Not just out of loyalty to Theo, but because I'd broken an unwritten rule between friends. A line you don't cross. As he put it, you think your shit doesn't stink, but it does. A few others followed. I stopped getting calls, stopped hanging out. They clearly wanted nothing to do with me. And Luna? It was messy. She couldn't handle it. And honestly, neither could I. When it ended, I was more alone than I'd ever been. The depression felt bottomless. That's when a friend offered me some LSD. I bought enough tabs for 3 days. I didn't have a grand plan. I just wanted something, anything that might crack the fog of depression open. It was a Hail Mary move. The trip itself drifted in and out. I remember riding my bike through town at night, ending up under a stand of redwoods. I stood there for a long time, surrounded by towering trunks and silence, the air thick and still. The moon cast faint shadows on the forest floor, and in my altered state, they looked like ghosts. I started talking to them, softly at first, then out loud, like they might listen, like maybe someone or something might answer. But there was no reply, no sign, nothing, just me reaching into the dark for something that wasn't there. Whatever I was hoping for didn't come. Mostly, it was a blur of exhaustion and static, and by the time the third and final night came about, I was no closer to clarity. If anything, I felt even more hopeless than when I started. As the final night ended, I put on this grainy, black-and-white, silent video a friend had left me. On it was footage from 1938 of the father of modern yoga, T. Krishnamacharya, and his young student, B.K.S. Iyengar, who would later become one of yoga's most influential teachers. Krishnamacharya looked like a kind of warrior priest. He was stern, commanding, and moved with razor-sharp precision. His protege, Iyengar, moved with such incredible grace and fluidity. This young man twisting and bending into impossible postures. There was nothing soft or serene about what I was seeing. It was all discipline, and I remember thinking, I could use some of that. I went to bed feeling defeated. Whatever door I'd hoped LSD might open, it stayed shut. But that video stayed with me. Those two bodies, that kind of power and control, it stirred something in me. It looked spiritual, elevated somehow. Sometime in the middle of the night, I heard a voice that jolted me upright. India. It wasn't a thought. It wasn't a dream. It was just a loud, clear message, as if it had been spoken directly to me. And with it, I felt a sudden calm wash through me. I knew what I had to do. I lay back down, and within 2 weeks, I was on a plane to India. Shaktipat, not really. I'd come to Mysore to study with Pattabhi Joyce. He was the guru of Ashtanga Yoga, a practice thick with discipline, precision, and flow. His teacher was the master I had seen in that 1938 black-and-white video, Krishnamacharya. Western students traveled from all over the world to learn from Joyce. I hoped that under his guidance, I would find what I couldn't find on my own, structure and a way to heal this grief. The streets in Mysore buzzed with life. Rickshaws weaved between bullock carts. Old women pressed cow dung patties onto walls to dry. And the smell of exhaust hung heavy in the air. India was chaotic and overwhelming, but it also felt alive. I didn't know exactly why, but I knew I had to be there. The night I arrived, a friend took me to meet Joyce at his house. He opened the door himself. He was small, pudgy, and smiling. For a moment, I thought I was in good hands. He seemed warm, almost grandfatherly. But the next morning, in that cramped back room behind Joyce's house, his warmth was gone. He sat on a little stool in the corner, barking commands like a drill sergeant. The room barely fit 12 mats, jammed edge to edge. The lower walls were painted a screaming maroon. The barred windows trapped the heat like an oven. And by 5 a.m., the air was already thick with sweat, nerves, and tension. Everyone moved at their own pace, but the room pulsed with unease. "Hey, bad lady," he'd yell from his perch. "Incorrect." People braced, waiting to be corrected, injured, or ignored. And some, especially the women, braced for something worse, because the truth is, he didn't just bark orders, he groped women. That morning, I saw it happen repeatedly. He pressed his pelvis into their buttocks, touched their breasts. There was this one woman in the corner he seemed especially fixated on. She was doing a series of advanced poses, deep back bends that most students couldn't even approach. I watched him go over to her again and again, adjusting her, hovering, and then literally grabbing her genitalia as he, quote, assisted her in those postures. It wasn't subtle. It wasn't ambiguous. He did it in plain view of the entire room. Then every so often, someone would finish their practice, get on their knees as he sat on his stool, and bow to him. Their middle fingers would touch his puffy feet, then their forehead three times. It was a ritual act of submission, white kids mostly, all surrendering to a man they barely understood. It wasn't reverence. It was people losing themselves in groupthink. I sat on the steps outside the room right next to a squat toilet. The smell was full-on diarrhea. People were so wrecked with nerves and intensity in that space, they'd bolt from the stairs mid-breath to explode in the stall, then shuffle back out, pale and shaking. Through the grated window, I could see bodies folded, yanked, shoved into deeper poses, limbs trembling, grunts escaping. My heart was pounding. Shit, it's my turn. I stepped inside, trying to match the vibe, but everywhere I looked, it felt like I'd stumbled into the Yoga Olympics. People moved like gymnasts and contortionists, their legs resting casually behind their heads and spines bending in ways that didn't seem physically possible. I watched a friend launch from downward dog, hover in midair, then land in some insane pose, hold it for several breaths, press up into a handstand, and float back down like it was no big deal. It was beautiful and terrifying at the same time. I was so intimidated that my body seized up. Yoga is supposed to be about awareness. There's this idea that real change happens when you meet your edge, that point where something is challenging but not damaging, where you're tuned in, not just muscling through pain to prove something. But that's not what Joyce was teaching. His version of, quote, spiritual growth didn't care where your edge was. He cared whether you obeyed, whether you let him take you past your limits without question. And if you didn't resist, even when it hurt like hell, that meant you were doing it right. That meant you were a real yogi. During one of the standing poses with my foot resting in half lotus on my thigh, Joyce came up behind me. Without a word, he grabbed my foot and wrenched it higher, pulling it into my groin. My knee popped so loudly it turned my stomach. Pain shot through my body, and suddenly I couldn't ignore the truth. I had flown halfway across the world and handed my body to someone who didn't give a shit if he hurt me. But I didn't say a word. I just kept breathing, pretending it was fine. I couldn't go home empty-handed. I'd staked everything on this trip, off some weird LSD revelation, and there was nothing waiting for me back home anyway. My friends didn't want anything to do with me. Stephen had made that clear. I was the guy who thought his shit didn't stink, and after what happened, I couldn't afford to be wrong. I had to prove this wasn't just another reckless, self-serving choice. So day after day, I kept going back to the shala, where Joyce kept forcing my knees further and further, grinding them past their limits. His students called it Shaktipat, a sacred transfer of energy from guru to disciple. But what I felt was something else entirely. My knees kept getting redder and more inflamed. Part of me still clung to the lie that this was sacred, that if I let him hurt me enough, something good would happen. the messenger. And then one late afternoon at a yoga potluck, I noticed this young man named Cole sitting cross-legged on the floor while we were eating. His spine was perfectly straight, his hands resting lightly on his knees. He looked like a Buddha. There was a stillness about him, almost luminous. He was different from the others. Curious, I asked him, "You seem different. Why is that?" He smiled, a knowing look in his eye. "I practice Vipassana," he said. "It's a meditation the Buddha taught. There's a course a few hours away in Sri Lanka. You should try it." His words felt like a lifeline. I had come all the way to India in search of peace, but by now my knees were red and swollen, my body breaking down. Every morning I watch students limp out of the shala, one after the other. Then one day I saw a friend leave class, barely able to walk. Joyce had ruptured his ligaments. That was it. I knew I would never be able to surrender to him. Voluntary torture. Within a few weeks, I found myself cross-legged on a thin blue square of foam, barely a cushion in a run-down Sri Lankan meditation center. The place was a cesspit. Rusted pipes that were supposed to be showers jutted from the cracked walls. Toilets reeked. It wasn't exactly the sanctuary I had hoped for. I stood there, swallowing hard, staring at this shithole I was about to willingly lock myself into for the next 10 days. There would be no speaking, no escape, just me, trapped in this decaying prison of a retreat center with nothing but my own mind. This was gonna suck. The rules were simple. No talking, no eye contact. From 4 in the morning until 9 at night, I was to sit with my attention turned inward, scanning every sensation in my body. I was to notice tingling, warmth, tightness, heaviness, jumpiness, and even the pressure of my clothes. I was not to react, not to move if I felt pain or discomfort, not to scratch if I itched, not to get up, no matter how unbearable it became. I was to sit and observe, letting whatever sensation I experienced arise, stay, and eventually pass away. Whatever I experienced, I was to remind myself that it was just a sensation and it was neither personal nor permanent. But sitting still for hours was pure torture. They had to prop me up against the wall just to give my back some support. And even then, it ached constantly. My knees hovered above the ground. My hips screamed. Every muscle was firing. All I could feel was pain, over and over again. There was nothing else, just pain. And the question running through my mind, what the hell am I doing here? No hiding. Without any distractions, the memories I'd buried about Scott came crashing in like waves. I couldn't escape the cruel words I'd hurled at him, the fights that got so vicious they left me bruised, the way I taunted him about his acne, about how weird he was. Honestly, I just wanted nothing to do with him. He embarrassed me. Every regret gnawed at me. This sour, burning flavor would rise from my stomach up to my throat. My chest felt heavy. I was trapped in a storm of guilt, drowning in the realization that I had been horrible to my brother, and now there was nowhere to hide. The stillness and silence only highlighted how much I had misunderstood him. Up until that moment, I had not recognized that he actually had a mental illness. I had just assumed he was weak and that he had let himself fall apart, seeing through the veil. In the final moments of the retreat, something profound happened. There was this heavy pressure in the center of my chest that kept getting sharper. But by then, I'd learned to sit perfectly still. As I tried to focus the pain away, it just kept getting more and more tender inside. It felt like a finger pressing on something raw. The harder I tried to control it, the more it slipped from my reach. Then something inside broke loose. It was more like a pressure valve blowing open. It was raw, sudden, not beautiful, but necessary. The hall had been dead silent. There were maybe 50 people meditating in stillness, and now my scream was slicing through it like a blade. I could feel every eye in the room on me, even though I couldn't see them. But then, in the stillness that followed, a vision of Scott appeared. He wasn't the broken version I had carried in my heart. He was whole and at peace. His eyes met mine, and I felt everything. Release, forgiveness, the knowing that he was okay. There were no words or explanations, just understanding. And then something in me shifted. The story I'd been telling about him and about myself cracked open. I saw how much fear had been hiding beneath my judgment, how hating his weakness had been a way to avoid facing my own. The wall between us finally fell, and in its place came something quieter, compassion, for him, for me, for how hard we'd both been trying to survive. In that moment, I could also see the rules that had shaped us both. The same expectations that crushed him had lived in me too. The belief that love had to be earned, that belonging came only through achievement, that tenderness made you weak. Maybe allowing myself to feel wasn't weakness at all. Maybe it was courage. Maybe this was the only way through, by feeling it, not fixing it. For the first time, maybe ever, I wasn't running or proving or holding anything together. I was just there, breathing inside the ache, letting it be. I took a deep breath, and something in me finally eased. At 21, I didn't have the words for it, but I knew one thing. I couldn't keep living by those rules anymore.